Well, good evening, everybody. This is the second in our series of discussions about substance abuse, and we have different people talking about this. And the the medications that we'll be talking about in general will be things like Oxycontin, oxycodone, roxycodone, Lortab, Norco, codeine, morphine, those kinds of things, and also potentially benzodiazepines such as Xanax, Ativan, Valium, Librium, those kind of things. Additionally, people will abuse other prescription medications such as gabapentin, Neurontin, or Lyrica, a variety of other things. And tonight we're going to have Danny Kellum is going to speak for a few minutes, and then Billy Busselmeyer is going to talk, and then we'll have a period of open discussion. So any questions you may have or brief comments are welcome. And if we can keep our comments pretty short because our time is pretty limited. Bible story time is tonight for the older group, and they'll be dismissed after Danny concludes his remarks. On Friday the 17th, Saturday. On Saturday, there's going to be a training for the use of naloxone, which is a reversal agent to rescue people who have overdosed on opiates. And this will be in Johnson City at the School of Pharmacy on Friday morning. There's a bulletin poster on the bulletin board. So, all right, it's Danny's turn.
Pardon me, and sorry if I have to do that a while. Looks like I've got about 12 and a half minutes. I think we want the initial part to be done by around 6:30. And so I'm going to be going rather rapidly. But I think as we sit back and, you know, I read all this literature about opiate dependency and all of that, and we look at what's causing it, and you can probably hear a lot of things, such as with recent legislative changes over the last few years, medical professionals are under an awful lot of pressure to make patient satisfaction go up here. And if they refuse a narcotic to someone that they think might be a drug seeker, someone who might be abusing drugs, and they don't give it to them, then that patient leaves, and that patient can give them a negative rating, and their patient satisfaction goes down, and then their evaluations are not what those who are above them want to see. And so that pressure is there, and there's a school of thought that says that that's one of the reasons that this particular addiction is spiraling out of control. Perhaps, society seems to be struggling with its identity right now. You've got this group pitted against this group, and they sort of seem to be blowing in the wind, and you know, who knows what's right. There's not much confidence in an absolute authority. People don't know who they are, and so what do? And this is one of the areas they go to for relief. But then there's another category. We don't need to lump them all into one pile. One basket. There's another category of those who are addicted to painkillers that it was fully intended. Wonderful people, believers. They wound up having rather extensive surgeries, and they were, with good reason, prescribed painkillers, but you know what? On down the road, they wound up being addicted to it. They'd never been addicted to drugs, alcohol, sex. It just wasn't a part of their existence. And so when we look at the populations of opiate dependents, you really have a lot of different features in one basket. And so it's important to not label them all the same way. But at the same time, there are things in common that they have with regard to the approach that's needed and with the way we see them, because regardless of what feature you are in that basket, whether you are an initial drug seeker or whether it was totally unintended, Jesus loves all the same. And it's really important that we have that perspective. So my angle is from the mental health point of view. And what does mental health intervention look like? And there are several different kinds of modalities that are used. And really, all of them are needed. Because if you look at those who are addicted to any substance, if all they do is get individual counseling, even if it's long-term, then their chances of success are not that high. But if they get individual counseling, if they get group counseling, if they go through a 12-step program, and if they get family counseling, and yes, you may be thinking, wow, that is really time-consuming. Yes, it is. But you know what? Opiate dependency is a really big deal. And so this much time is justified. When they do all of that, their chances of recovery and long-term sobriety increase dramatically. And there are reasons for that. But let me go through what, you know, is rather involved in each of them. With regards to individual counseling, one of the things that's frequently used is called cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's designed to reframe the way these patients view their struggle, help them to learn to interpret it differently, and then engage in behaviors that reflect that new belief. So for instance, if they're feeling a craving that says, oh, I'm in terrible, terrible pain, and they really may not be, you know, it could be more of a psychosomatic type of thing. They might be thinking, boy, I have to have this. How do you interpret that craving? You know, cravings are not a disaster. And we usually use terms whenever we're under a lot of pressure and stress, like, oh, this is horrible and terrible and awful. And we need to get rid of those terms. We need to use terms like, this is painful, this hurts, this is unfortunate, this is undesirable. What's different from those terms than the previous terms? Horrible, terrible, awful seem to say, this is not an acceptable condition for me to be in. I can't feel this, therefore I've got to go to do something that's going to help me feel better really fast. The other terms, painful, unfortunate, uncomfortable, undesirable, those are terms that give us permission to feel the discomfort. They say, you know what, it's okay to be uncomfortable. That discomfort doesn't have to go away anytime really soon. And so it's real important to learn to reframe cravings that way. And it really is a psychological process. And then we have to engage in behaviors where if the craving comes, not only should you think a certain way, but you should get up and go to a place to where access to whatever it is one is addicted to is not as high. So individual counseling is very important. And it also provides, you know, medical guidance as to what's going on. Group counseling, let me back up. Let me go to 12-step first. 12-step begins with the acknowledgement that we are powerless over the addiction. That may be the most difficult one because the one of the first presenting symptoms, at least on an emotional basis, of any addict is denial. I don't care if it's opiate dependence, I don't care if it's alcohol, drugs, sex, exercise, technology. The first, you know, emotional symptom is usually denial. And it can be very challenging to penetrate that denial. And, you know, there might be thinking, well, you know, I'm not addicted. I really need this. But if you can ever get to them to that 12-step program and get them to really process, I am powerless over this, I need help, then that's the first step in a long journey. And part of that journey involves 11 other steps, which includes, in the literature, surrendering to a higher being as you see it. And that higher being, of course, we are confident is God. But all of those lead to a journey of health, and those are very good. But then you've got the group experience. And the group counseling and family counseling have a whole lot in common because their goals are twofold. One is accountability. If you're in a good group counseling session and you're starting to deny or you're starting to minimize, they're going to call you on it. They're going to go, no, 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 no. Get focused. Be honest. You're not really being upfront with us. They're good at that. But the next thing they need is affirmation. And the group is going to be very focused on supporting the person, on affirming them as important and valuable, and yes, on loving them. That's why the group experience is very powerful. It's also very helpful to be in an experience to where you're sharing a struggle with someone else who is going through the same struggle you are. But also, if the group is structured properly, you're going to have others who are in the group, and most likely the leader, but some others who have gone through this process, and they've reached sobriety, and they've maintained sobriety for a long time. They've been there. So you know that they know what you're going through. But it's invaluable. The family therapy process is also very important. Families are a huge component in the treatment of any kind of addiction. Families, it's very easily to fall into the function of an enabler to where you engage in behavior. You might gripe and complain and get emotional and lose your temper, but you don't wind up still holding them accountable. You just vent, and that usually makes things worse because it increases the stress and the tension, and they want to go to whatever they're craving even much more. And so what is taught in family counseling is boundaries. It may be that the spouse of the addict needs to be the one who dispenses all medications. The spouse has possession of every pill bottle. The spouse is able to help their spouse along by not allowing them access to the medications. It can be a good idea for the spouse, if they haven't been before, to become involved in financial management. Because if you start looking at where the money's going and you don't know where the money's going, then that money might be going to purchasing these medications. So family involvement is very helpful there. Family can do that in a way that a group cannot. But the family is also trained to be supportive, to confront without being difficult, without losing their temper, without becoming overly emotional, but also to affirm their spouse or their other loved one in the family because they really need it. An addict needs support. An addict needs affirmation, and that addict needs love. And not only is it the family, but for the addict, his or herself, he is going to be trained, look, acknowledge the fact that you are in this world to where your addiction is all-encompassing. It's all you think about. You're powerless over it. It's in your mind 24/7. You need to learn to change that. Yeah, it's in your mind, but now I want you to think about your wife or your husband or your child or your parent. Because if you're a full-blown addict, you're not much of a giver. Now we're going to retrain you to be a giver. You're going to step out of this mode of thinking about painkillers all the time, and you're going to start thinking about your family, and you're going to start finding ways to give to them, whether it's helping with this, or taking them out on a date, or taking kids to the playground, or what have you. All of those things are very important. A couple of passages, and there are dozens of passages that are related to this, but I like Matthew 26:41. We're taught, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. This could happen to any of us. Professional people can be especially vulnerable because professional people are often very, you know, kind of OCD type, very particular and kind of on edge. And when you are and you experience some relief, then you're vulnerable to wanting that particular kind of relief to continue. But I also love Hebrews 4, 15 and 16, and you've heard this passage, but it's important. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way as we, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. I've shared this with addicts before, and they say, you really think Jesus was an addict? I said, well, he might not be, but when he was tempted in that wilderness and he was hungry, do you think he wasn't craving food? I can just about guarantee you he was craving food just as much as you're craving drugs or sex or alcohol or whatever it is. He knows what it's like to crave. But yet he did it without sin, so you can go to him and receive grace and mercy from him on that throne of grace. Never will forget, I had a particular client. I'd worked with him about 4 years, and he was an addict. And as we were gradually weaning him off of therapy and working toward getting to where we were going to terminate the counseling process, we talked about what's he going to miss about the counseling experience. And he said, the thing that concerns me the most is, he said, from you, I'm getting relentless affirmation. And I never will forget those words. And I'm thrilled that he used those words, because in the course of those 4 years, believe me, he got a lot of confrontation from me. But when I would compliment him, he would often be angry because he wouldn't believe the good that I could see in him. And he resisted it. It's just how low the sense of self for an addict can become. And I'd make him ask, I don't care if you believe me or not. I'm going to keep on complimenting you, and I'm not going to lie about it. And, you know, Jesus is the same way. He sees good in us. He sees potential in us, even if we don't see it. And his throne of grace is relentless with grace. Our responsibility is to realize that we are important to him, and he wants to extend that grace to us. Because that is where we can be affirmed, that is where we can be loved, that is where we can genuinely feel forgiven, and that is where we can be encouraged to go down a healthier path. So, a couple of bits of real quick advice on planning ahead. If you are anticipating a major surgery, or if you know someone who has just had a major injury due to an accident or something, talk with your physician and develop a plan as to what getting off the pain meds are going to look like. Your physician is very willing to do that. Be proactive. Now, you're not likely to become addicted if you go through one refill, but you can start liking this stuff, and you want to develop a plan of action with your family to where this is the protocol that I'm going to follow. And it may not be totally exact, but you can go from hardcore to less powerful to less powerful, and eventually wean yourself off of this. That's a good idea because it can help you from becoming one of those who accidentally got into an addiction without meaning to. All right. Billy?
Can y'all hear me all right? Pretty good? All right. My name is Billy Buselmeyer. Some of y'all I don't know. Just a little bit about myself and what I do. I'm a family medicine physician, which means I'm also a primary care physician, if that makes a little bit more sense to kind of fit me into a box. Additionally, I'm a faculty member at a family medicine residency, which is means one of my jobs is also to teach other family medicine physicians to do this job. Additionally, I work in an outpatient clinic, and I also work in a hospital, treating patients in both of those sorts of places. Before we go any further, though, I personally feel the need to just talk something out. This is a pretty heavy subject. It can be kind of touchy. A lot of people have different feelings and thoughts and pretty strong emotions about this subject. I am not a narcotic abuse expert. I'm not an addiction expert. I'm not a pain specialist. I'm not any of those. I have had friends whose lives have been negatively impacted by substance abuse, but I'm not going to try and say, you know, I'm an expert in the personal, physical, and emotional trauma that can come from substance addiction. I just want to talk with y'all a little bit about how I see this problem through the lens of my faith and also being a family medicine physician. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time about talking about whether or not this is a problem. I believe Steve talked about that in the video, hit that pretty well last month. But I do want to say right now, in Tennessee, people are more likely to die from a drug overdose than from in a car wreck, homicide, or suicide combined, okay? In 2016, 1,631 total drug overdose deaths. We don't have the numbers for 2017 yet, but I expect them to be probably at least 10% higher if they follow all the trends of the preceding years. So without question, it's a very, very big problem. What I would like to talk a little bit more about are some of the deeper issues behind why people get addicted to narcotics, how I view this problem professionally and personally, and again, talk through some things just as one Christian to another. To me, though, the first thing to talk about whenever we're talking about something like narcotic addiction, it's talking about pain. Narcotics treat pain. And you know what? I personally don't really like pain. I don't know if I'm alone in that. I don't really like it. I kind of have to, you know, get psyched up, you know, just to get like a little flu shot, which, by the way, I do want to throw out there. If you haven't already gotten your flu shot, you should talk with your doctor about getting a flu shot right now. But I don't like pain, okay? Anybody in here ever broken a bone before? Broken your arm, broken your leg? Yeah, it really hurts, doesn't it? And you want something and you need and deserve something to help take care of that pain. Okay, how about moms in the room? Childbirth, painful much? Is that something unpleasant? Maybe a little bit painful? Yes. So all that to say, pain is something that's very real. It's a problem and it's something that deserves to be treated and taken care of. I want to talk about some different types of pain though. Think about when you've had a loved one die. You know, it's not really physical pain, but your heart aches when your parent, your spouse, your child dies. That's a painful thing. How about depression? I see people in my practice who hurt so much emotionally they can't even get out of bed to go take care of their children most days out of the week. That's pain as well. You think about different sorts of emotional and psychological traumas. In Appalachia, which includes us, our rates of child abuse, sexual assault, intimate partner violence, our rates right here higher than many, 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 many other places in the country. And these sorts of things cause wounds, they cause scars that, you know, people can't really just put aside. And there aren't very many medicines that help these sorts of things. So there's a lot of other pains just from physical pains, too. And you know what? Narcotics have a way of dulling those specific sorts of pain. Narcotics have this weird property where, you know, they make people dull, not just to the physical pain they're experiencing, but maybe the emotional, psychological sorts of pain they're experiencing as well. So they pose a unique temptation to folks struggling with really, really, really bad psychological pain. Now that we've talked a little bit about pain, though, I'd like to talk about narcotics specifically. So my professional take on narcotics is they are a tool. Steve last month compared them to a hammer. I would like to compare them to a chainsaw, if I may. So I want y'all to imagine catastrophe strikes, great big giant 50-foot tree falls down, pins somebody to the ground. You need a chainsaw to cut the tree up really, really quick, get the guy out from under the tree, okay? Likewise, that guy who the tree fell on, maybe he broke his back, maybe he broke his leg, he's going to be hurting. He needs a heavy-duty pain medicine like a narcotic to take care of that pain. There's one important similarity, though, between chainsaws and narcotics. If they are not used with great care, you can kill somebody. Another similarity, not very versatile tools. You know, chainsaws have maybe one use, or unless you're bear sculpting, you know, maybe have that kind of a use as well. But mainly just one use. Let's talk a little bit about the science behind narcotics. A lot of studies show that they do actually, you know, help alleviate pain, but they're not really as good at it as a lot of us like to think they are. There's been a lot of studies here recently showing that narcotics don't really help control a lot of different types of pain more than just a medicine like Aleve or ibuprofen. There are also some studies that show some really minimal evidence, but there is evidence that they can improve some function and have some long-term benefit, but it's minimal evidence and it's got a lot of side effects as well. And I do feel compelled to say that there's, not too long ago, there's a real interesting study came out, talked about using long-acting narcotics. These would be things like OxyContin. I'm sure everybody's heard of that. But using medicines like that to treat non-cancer-related chronic pain, people who have that and who are using those medicines to treat their pain die more often than people using other medicines to control their pain. Additionally, there's obviously the inherent possibility for narcotic misuse, abuse, diversion, meaning, you know, you are either selling that medicine or someone is taking it away from you, addiction and overdose deaths. Now, on the other side of the coin, there's a lot of people who have chronic, severe, very, very debilitating pain. And these people have failed all other ways of controlling their pain, and they're not really able to function in their lives. Some of those folks, they could probably benefit from a medication like a narcotic. But even then, there's some still pretty big risks in using these sorts of medicines. I also want to be very, very clear. You know, I'm not saying that if anybody in here uses a narcotic or a loved one is on a medicine like that, that they are evil, they're going to die, get addicted, anything like that. I'm not saying that at all. Or if, you know, your doctor prescribes one for you that he or she is, you know, just malpractice or doesn't know what they're doing, I'm not saying any of that at all. All I'm saying is that these are tools. They can be very dangerous tools and should be used by all of us with a pretty hefty respect. I'd also at this juncture like to share some personal thoughts on them. I have taken a narcotic before myself. I was a teenager, had my wisdom teeth removed, hurt a whole lot. I think my mom gave me half of a medicine like Lortab. Didn't really help a whole lot with the pain. Made me feel like I was breathing kind of funny, which is actually a common side effect for some of these medicines. Additionally, I've had two friends to suffer from narcotic addiction. One guy got into a real, real bad motorcycle accident, broke his leg in numerous places. He had to be in the hospital for weeks in kind of a fixation device where he wasn't able to move his leg. He ended up getting addicted to the narcotics, but he had a lot of other compounding demons on top of that, which led to that. But he went into rehab and got clean. Unfortunately, another friend of mine, a guy who I grew up with, 4 years younger than I am, my mom called me 3 weeks ago, told me he died from a narcotic overdose. I was at his funeral last week. He was 27 years old. So I have some personal feelings about narcotics that makes me not really wild about using them or about them in general. Professionally, I see a whole lot of folks who struggle with narcotic addiction. In the clinic, we'll see folks who have, you know, track marks on their arms where you see where the needles have been. They've been using needles to inject their drugs. I've seen people with real, real bad skin or bone or brain infections because of the bacteria that they've been injecting into their systems as well. And I've interacted with a whole lot of people, both in the clinic and in the hospital. If any of y'all have interacted with some of these sorts of folks, it can be an extremely difficult interaction, and sometimes rather unpleasant. Quite frequently, when I don't give these people what they want, I've had folks storm out of the office. I've had folks sneak out of the hospital when they weren't getting the things that they wanted. I've also been cussed out. I've been flipped off a few times. And once here recently, I had someone very gently just pat me on the shoulder as they walked out of my office because I didn't know what I was doing when I didn't give them a narcotic. These people can be really hard, really unpleasant people to work with. But God still loves them. Jesus still died on the cross for them. It was my sins, just the same as theirs, that put him up on the cross. God sees me and my sins and your sins no different from any of those other sins like substance abuse, narcotic addiction, any of that. We're all equal. We're all equally guilty in God's eyes. So thanks be to God that he loved all of us to die for our sins, no matter what they are. So to sum up this kind of long discussion, which I appreciate y'all bearing with me, I want to end with some admonitions. Number one, be compassionate and be loving. If you know or encounter someone who's struggling against substance addiction, they need your love, and you know what? It's going to take a whole lot more work to love that person probably than a lot of other people, so just be prepared for that. But nonetheless, that person really needs the love of a Christian. Don't forget, that person probably didn't wake up one day and decide, you know, I'm going to be go out and get addicted to narcotics today. You know, odds are, there's someone who's struggling with a whole lot of other really, really deep problems in their life, something that you may never understand or may never, ever be able to fathom, something that led them to this seeking a medicine like this to dull some of their pain. And above all, don't forget that Jesus loves them just like he loves all of us too. Number two is be personally careful. Kind of like Danny was just saying, if a doctor prescribes you a narcotic, it's probably safe and appropriate for you to take it. Don't be afraid, though, to politely ask your doctor, is this medicine something I really need? Do I really need this? Is this the best medicine for me? I'm a big fan of having those sorts of conversations with my patients, and I encourage you to have those sorts of conversations with your doctor as well. And if you do end up taking a narcotic, again, it's probably going to be okay. Please, though, take it exactly the way it is written, for exactly the pain it is intended to. Meaning that if it was prescribed for your broken leg, please don't just take it for a headache. And do not take any more than is necessary to control your pain. And if you got some left over, please don't just leave it lying around your house or even locked in a medicine cabinet. This creates an opportunity for, you know, a child, your spouse, or even you to have access to this medicine and take it when you really don't need it, which can lead to pretty big problems. There are many, many, many unwanted pharmaceutical take-back locations across the state of Tennessee. There are a lot of police department stations. I'll help you find one on Google if you need to figure out where to take this kind of stuff. Be glad to. Number three, please be aware. This problem is ubiquitous, especially in our region. For your friends and your family members, you know them, love them, be involved in their lives, and be on the lookout for, you know, something that might mean that something's not going right in their life. And number four is to be brave. Many of us have friends or loved ones who struggle with this. And you might know somebody right now who is having this kind of a fight. Or you might have somebody that you just know something's different and you can't quite put your finger on it. Be brave enough and love them enough to reach out to that person and talk with them about this. And you know what? If there's someone here tonight struggling with this, you're in for a fight. You are in a fight for your life. Be brave enough to tell somebody. Please ask for help. Find help. And don't give up. We've got a lot of folks leading these discussions, a lot of folks in this church who would love to help you and who can help you. In any way about it, you need the Lord's help. Whether you're already baptized or haven't yet given your life over to God, your journey starts with seeking God's help. I think right now we're going to go for some questions. And again, if possible, please keep your questions brief so we can get to as many questions as possible. No more than 30 seconds or so. And I don't know if any of the other guys who are leading these discussions, if y'all wanted to come up, if there's a question that one of y'all might be able to answer better than me or Danny, if we wanted to do that as well. So, any questions?
Yes, Louise, and we also have Dan and Michael who will be able to answer questions, and you can direct your question to any one of us or just in general, and whoever has the answer will then try to answer it. So Louise. So when medication is prescribed, the person doesn't take it because they're afraid they'll become addicted. What do you tell them to make it more appropriate?
I would tell them that there is a very, very low risk of becoming addicted to that medicine. Again, if you take it the way it's prescribed for no longer than the length it is prescribed. And again, I would always encourage, if that's a concern you have, or if anybody has, please talk with your doctor. But in general, there's a very low risk of that kind of problem happening when you've got a significant pain that needs that kind of a medicine for.
Michael, yes.
Danny spoke of patient satisfaction.
I must admit, first and foremost, that I get to have a little bit of a luxury of being protected from that kind of a thing. I work for the state. I just get to do what I think is best for people, and you know, I want to help them, but if my patient satisfaction goes down because they don't like the fact that I didn't use a narcotic, I personally don't care a whole lot. But as far as other things, you know, none of us like to see people suffering, and if there's something that we can do, we want to do it. We want to try and help people. I think last time, Steve, you talked about that whole kind of movement that, you know, I think it was 10, 20 years ago, about the whole pain as another vital sign movement, and you know, there was a great big push like, oh, there is pain. I must treat it to zero. We don't really think about it that way anymore. You know, to look at your question in another way, one of the big things to emphasize is also function. You know, is my goal is to help somebody, you know, not get their pain to zero. My goal is to help them function better in their daily life. So that's another way to look at that similar kind of issue.
What systemic issues do we have that make us a more difficult area as opposed to the rest of the nation?
Poverty, other substance abuses, other sorts of social strife, lack of opportunity, other sorts of social problems that we in Appalachia experience very, very frequently. What other thoughts do you have?
There is a community in Southwest Virginia.
Use the mic.
Okay.
There's a community in Southwest Virginia that has a population of about 400 people. And it was known that about 395 of them were addicted to alcohol. They are an isolated community in a holler. There's very little money in this community. There's not much to stimulate any kind of other activity. They're a long way from movie theaters. They're a long way from baseball and football fields. And so there's a lot of that in this area. And also stats will bear out, if you're in an isolated community like Winnemucca, Nevada, to where you're 60 miles away from the nearest gas station after you leave your own town, then it's not just opiate, but any kind of other drug dependency really skyrockets. And so we've got a lot of these isolated communities in our area, and with these families, their social skills not being very good, they don't know how to have healthy family interaction, they don't know how to give and to establish boundaries, these kinds of things are ripe to happen.
Mentioned one other thing, and I know we're talking about narcotics as well. I can't help but also mention real briefly about marijuana. I know we talked a lot about that last week. Marijuana is, it's just plain Jane marijuana, right? There's nobody, and the people who sell marijuana, they're all upstanding citizens. They're not conniving or businessmen or anything like that. Wrong. Marijuana nowadays is not just marijuana. It's marijuana that's been laced with fentanyl. It's marijuana that's been laced with cocaine or methamphetamine or any of these other sorts of things. So one of the other systemic issues is this is a business, and people who are selling these sorts of things have a business mentality to make people want their product and come back to it over and over and over and over again. So that's another part of the systemic problem. If I may say real quick, specifically about equal, maybe. There's a lot of studies that show there's no difference. That's a good question. We didn't have these sorts of studies that compared opiates to Aleve or opiates to ibuprofen years ago. These are things that people are wanting to look at a whole lot more right now because this is such a big problem. So some of it is just more and more of this information is coming to light, and we're realizing, these medicines work, but maybe they don't really work as good as just some good old Aleve. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. A little more to that. Just recently, I read a study that was published looking at comparing opiate pain medication to a combination of ibuprofen and acetaminophen, which is like, ibuprofen and Tylenol given together. And this was people who were admitted to the emergency department of a hospital and had, significant pain, broken bones, appendicitis, that kind of thing. And of this group, it was a few hundred people, they discovered, and it was a bit of a surprise, that the combination of ibuprofen and acetaminophen, or ibuprofen and Tylenol, provided equivalent pain relief to the opiates, which is like Percocet and Lortab, with fewer problems. Additionally, it depends on what type of pain we're treating. If it's neuropathic pain, like fibromyalgia or diabetic neuropathy, those kind of things don't respond very well to opiates. And so, but people have used opiates in an attempt to get relief, but it is not worked nearly as well as we would hope. So we've been treating a lot of people with the wrong medication sometimes. So you had your... Right. That's Marie is saying that as sort of a secondary fallout from the a drug abuse situation is that people who legitimately need opiate pain medications and may need them for a long time are now finding that they can't get them. Their physician retires or they get a new policy in the office or something and suddenly they're told, nope, we don't prescribe that. And I've heard that from a number of people. And the issue of being able to get insulin syringes, needles for your insulin, had one of the employees at where I work had the exact same issue. They couldn't get needles for their... They were insulin-dependent diabetic, and they couldn't get needles because they're clamping down on it so much. And so that is a fallout from that. I can send you the insulin, but not the needles to give it with. Yeah, I know. Right. That is a problem. Yes. Oh, yeah. All right. I think we've got time probably for one more question. Oh. Okay. Yes, Mary. Mary is talking about we have problems having enough mental health resources in our area, and it is critical. I work at Woodridge Hospital. At times, we have had a waiting list of 40 people waiting to get into the hospital, and that's unacceptable. There's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, and I hope it's not a train coming our way, but there's three things. Strategic Behavioral Health is building a new psychiatric hospital in Kingsport. They're competing with Ballot Health now, and that's one thing that's going to be happening fairly soon. The other thing, Ballot Health has committed a rather substantial amount of money toward mental health services, and in fact, they have to fulfill that to meet some of the requirements for the state of Tennessee. So that's coming. I don't know how soon that will be. The new clinic in Gray, Over Mountain Recovery, at this point provides methadone treatment and required counseling along with that, which is a good resource. And over the course of the next couple years, they're hoping to expand into different types of treatment modalities, specifically using buprenorphine and naltrexone. But that's not here yet. So those, I see some hope, but it, like today or this week, we're really in a bad situation. Bill, did you have something? You were pointing me to her. Okay. All right. I hate for us to stop, but we have to. In just a little bit, Steve's going to lead us in an invitation song. It's number 918 in the book, Out of My Bondage. Tim.
This time last week, a lot of people were thinking about Super Bowl. And I think a day before, there was a story that was published first on NOLA.com, New Orleans, Louisiana.com, searching for Jackie Wallace. Have any of you read that? That's a story you should look up. It's powerful. It's about a photojournalist in New Orleans who was out just looking for homeless people to take photos of, doing a story, found this one man lying on a rusted box spring with cardboard on top, and he was lying under a sheet of clear plastic for a cover. And so he went and asked permission to take his photo and found out this man had played in 2 Super Bowls. Jackie Wallace had been in 2 Super Bowls, and here he was, homeless, penniless, a drug addict. It had happened when somebody offered him cocaine. Well, the good thing that came out of that was this photojournalist that wrote the story helped him find resources. He got him back into a functioning mode, doing well, married, and then again slipped off. And then a few years later, found him. He was back in recovery, doing well. And the story closes with a plea. If anybody knows where Jackie Wallace is, let me know. Because again, he's going under. He's again using. This tells us how powerful Satan has used this tool. And I like the analogy that Billy uses here. It can be a wonderful tool, it can be a deadly tool. And it just shows that when that happens, people need help. I'm going to read from Galatians 6, 1 and 2. This is not about drug abuse, but it very much applies. Galatians 6, 1 and 2. Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. I think the message tonight has been very simple. Number one, if you are not using, just being tempted maybe by friends or schoolmates to give it a try, run from it. Stay away. But the other message is, if you are involved, if you are in this situation, there are people here that care. I mean, the fact that all these people are here tonight I think, shows there's a lot of people that care. And we may not understand your situation fully, but we understand Christ's love, and we're willing to help. The church is a good place to begin. We can't give you all the help you'll need, but we'll be by your side while you get it. And so tonight, become a part of the family. If you're not, if you have faith that Jesus is God's Son, then tonight, because you are ready to repent of your sin, ready to confess Him as the Son of God, then tonight be baptized into Christ. There's the first step toward freedom. And if you have done that and yet have not been faithful, we urge you to come home, come to a family that loves you, come to the Lord that can save you. Come tonight as we stand and sing.